going to go on another kind of more extended than I should do, and I do it anyway. That's why it's my podcast. On a subject that I've actually dealt with for over two decades now. And believe it or not, it has everything to do with gardening, and it's the use of peat moss. Peat moss is an extremely valuable source of organic matter that's been broken down over thousands, if not millions of years, and we're abusing it. In certain parts of the world, like I think it's Iceland, they actually burn it to heat their homes. But if they realized how valuable it is in nature, they wouldn't do that. I ran a company called Gardenville for a few years, 9 retail outlets, and I actually quit buying and wouldn't let them sell bags of sphagnum peat moss. And when you hear this story, you'll see why. It's a little bit involved. You get bored with it. I'm sorry. It's going to take 10, 12 minutes, but it's well worth it. And it's the latest thing we know about peat moss worldwide. I recommend now coconut coir, even though I don't like that some of that coir comes from halfway around the world. Most of ours doesn't. Most of ours in the United States now is coming out of Central America and Mexico. But it works just as good, if not better, for uses in our gardens and in our flower pots, and does not strip the world of a very, very valuable organic material that holds far more CO2 per pound than the best tree you've ever read about. So just why do I think the world's peatlands can actually help stabilize the climate? Peatlands make up only about 3% of the Earth's landscape. However, yet it absorbs very large amounts of carbon and harbors surprising biodiversity. Although peat bogs and fens are under increasing environmental threat, efforts to protect and restore their ecosystems are gathering momentum all across the world. Let's tie it together first with a little natural history that I bet only a handful of us knew about. I certainly didn't know till I started doing my studies, trying to find some sources. The Owimi borer is a yellowish-brown moth, an inch and a half in wingspan, a little tiny guy. In the often colorful world of lepidopterology, I only say that word once, the study of moths and butterflies is not particularly flashy, but is exceedingly rare. For decades, entomologists thought the moth lived in the sand dunes and oak savannas of southern Manitoba and the Great Lakes region of the United States. No one really knew. But then, in the year 2005, they had found only 6 specimens from 4 widely scattered areas in North America, and none more had been found. Many doubted, as a matter of fact, the moth even still existed, until one was discovered in a peatland fen, a peatland area, in the backwoods of an upper Michigan area in 2009. And that was a game-changer moment for an entomologist, lepidopterologist, I'll try that, named Kyle Johnson. His easygoing hunt for Owimi switched gears into an intense one. Instead of focusing on the sand dunes of upper Michigan and Wisconsin, he and his colleagues put on rubber boots, mosquito jackets, bug hats, and began squishing through dozens of peatland fens, traveling nearly 1,000 miles on foot from the upper peninsula of Michigan to eastern Saskatchewan. In all, Johnson and his colleagues spent 123 nights capturing moths at bait stations and netting free-flying adults. And that it took 8 years, incidentally, folks. In that 8-year search for Owimi, they added just 59 new specimens of that borer to the list of discoveries. Johnson was delighted, but not surprised, given the number of rare species often harbored by peatland fens. Let me throw another little factoid in here that most people aren't aware of. I certainly was. A square meter. What is a square meter? 3 by 3 meters. 9. Okay. Of Canadian peatland holds 5 times more carbon per area than that same area, a square meter, of Amazon rainforest, which we treasure so much. As a definition, peat is a partially decomposed plant material that builds up over centuries and millennia into oxygen-starved, waterlogged conditions. Representing just 3% of the world's landscape, bogs and fens and to a lesser extent swamps and marshes that accumulate peat, are found around the world, including Hawaii's Alakaia Swamp, which nurtures some of the rarest plants in the world, found in the Rockies, where peatlands at 10,000 feet are home to literally Ice Age plants that no longer live anywhere, in the Hudson Bay lowlands and even up in northern Siberia, the two largest carbon storehouses in the world, incidentally, and in the central Congo, where 55,000 square miles of peatland weren't discovered at all until the year 2017. As small as that little footprint is, however, the role they play in climate regulation, water filtration, flood and wildfire mitigation, and as refuges for many newly discovered and critically endangered species is an outsized one that raises serious questions about the ongoing degradation caused by a host of factors. These include, of course, something we can take care of if we don't: climate change, wildfire, roads, energy projects such as the Alberta oil sands, sphagnum peat harvesting for crops and gardens, and peat mining in countries that continue to still burn it for a fuel and to make electricity. Current studies suggest that such exploitation has drained, destroyed, and or degraded over 190,000 square miles of the world's peatlands, an area just about the size or slightly larger than the whole state of California. Still, large swaths of the world's peatlands remain intact, and successful restoration efforts are now well underway. Of course, as humans, we're part of the problem. We've been draining in peatlands for more than 1,000 years to clear bogs for agriculture and to burn peat for fuel. The perception that these wetlands were sources of disease added impetus to the degradation, which continues today in places such as Indonesia, where agribusiness has been draining and burning vast areas of peatlands, of course, for what? Oil palm plantations. FYI, folks, peatlands are unrivaled in their ability to regulate climate. 1 square meter, I mentioned this earlier, of peatland from the Hudson Bay lowlands of northern Canada, which incidentally is the second largest peatland in the world, holds 5 times the amount of carbon as a square meter of tropical forest does. As more peatlands are lost, vast amounts of carbon stored within them are released. Siberian peatland fires in 2020 emitted a record now, 244 million tons of carbon dioxide during that one burn. And being the nature nerd I am, I found this particular fact kind of interesting. Scientists are only beginning to discover the new roles that these soggy ecosystems play. Some, such as providing insulated dens for the Massasauga rattlesnakes, who cares besides me, Georgian Bay, Ontario, food and refuge of endangered woodland caribou, and the habitat needed to reintroduce critically endangered species such as the red wolf and even the cockaded woodpecker in peatlands of the Alligator and Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuge there in North Carolina. And for a little good news, scientists continue to find highly productive peatlands in really unlikely places, like the extremely high elevations of the Rocky Mountains. Such high elevation peatlands cover only about 1% of the land surface in the Beartooth Mountains of Wyoming and 1% of the San Juan Mountains of Colorado. But in each case, the distinct nature of these mountain fens plays an oversized role in supporting insects, plants, and animals, and in storing water and carbon. 18 small peatlands inventoried in Wyoming contain 32 either unknown and or threatened plants, 4 of them, including the small round-leafed orchid, bearberries, and low blueberry willow, are found nowhere else that we know right now anywhere in the area. In another recent find, scientists have identified 1,738 peatland fens, that's areas, covering over 11,000 acres in the Compagre and Gunnison National Forest just in Colorado, 90% of which were at elevations ranging from 9,000 to 12,000 feet. I think one of the highest areas, at least certainly in our part of the country, where they found peat. And the discoveries continue. In 2018, a fellow named Patrick Maldawin, an ecologist at the University of Toronto, discovered a carnivorous pitcher plant. I love carnivorous plants. Don't ask me why. Literally eating little juvenile salamanders in the peatlands of Ontario's Algonquin Provincial Park. If there is good news, the recent loss of peatlands is not as irreversible as the decline of sea ice or maybe the meltdown of glaciers. Scientists estimate that 80% of the world's 4 million square kilometers of peatlands are still largely in pristine condition. Many of those that are degraded can be easily and economically restored simply by re-wetting them after donor seeds, sphagnum, and other mosses are introduced from other areas. Since 2010, for instance, Russia has been doing this with the help of Germany to stop the spread of runaway wildfires. Peat just doesn't burn when it's wet, especially in Siberia. China has successfully done this with the Zogi Plateau, the most extensive mountain peatland in the world. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is now re-wetting the Great Dismal Swamp. That's a vast peatland along the Virginia-North Carolina border that George Washington, among others, tried to drain before he became president. More than 150 miles of roads, canals, and ditches in the refuge go back to the days before or during Washington's era. These and other disturbances have disrupted the natural flow of water, drying out the peat to the point where a single lightning strike from a thunderstorm can light it off, and it may burn for months, if not years. Most people don't realize that smoldering fires like that can burn so deeply that it sometimes takes a tropical storm or even a hurricane to put them out. A hydrologist named Fred Wooster of the U.S. Game and Fish Service says it's worth the effort of re-wetting it because we not only reduce the amount of severity of wildfire, we also mitigate flooding and keep the carbon in the ground where it ought to be. It can take a long time for the peatlands to form naturally, but we can restore them much faster. But what comes back to us is not exactly what was originally there, although we're getting better at recolonizing them correctly. But it's expensive and complicated by the drying that comes from our climate ever changing. Best idea, folks, best strategy is to protect what we already know is there. Thanks for staying tuned to Organic Matters. See you next week.